Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. Little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our Patreon sponsors. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor yourself, you can check out the link below or just go to the bodybuildinglegendshow.com website, and the link to become a Patreon donor will be in the upper right-hand corner. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's show, we have part three of our interview with the great Rick Wayne, one of the best writers to ever write in the bodybuilding magazines. He was a great bodybuilding writer for Joe Weider, for Muscle Builder magazine back in the day, and also for Flex magazine. And Rick was also the author of several books, including Muscle Wars, which was fantastic, and The Body Men, and also the Three More Reps books. And Rick was a great bodybuilder himself. He was the 1967 IFBB Mr. World winner, and he placed high in many other contests. He got to know Arnold when Arnold was only 19 years old. So Rick has a great history in the sport of bodybuilding, and I've been trying for several years to get Rick on the show, and he finally agreed to it, and we had a fantastic interview that went almost 3 hours long, and that's why we made this a three-part interview. So sadly, today is the last part of our interview with Rick Wayne, but I know a lot of people out there have reached out to me and have really, really enjoyed it. So I'm really glad we had a chance to do this with Rick Wayne. So at the end of our interview with Rick, I'm going to read another one of his articles. I've been going through all my old magazines and picking out different articles that Rick wrote so I could share with you guys, because I usually read articles at the end of each podcast interview. And today we're going to go not so old. This is one Rick was writing for Flex magazine. It comes from the March 1985 issue of Flex, and it is the 1984 Mr. Olympia report. And this, of course, was the contest where Lee Haney won his first Mr. Olympia contest out of eight Mr. Olympias that Lee won. But also, this was the historic event where Sergio Oliva made his comeback to the IFBB and the Mr. Olympia. And it was the first time he had competed in the IFBB since, well, I was going to say the 1972 Olympia, but I guess you could count the 1973 Mr. International contest in Tijuana, Mexico, since he was also a part of that. So over 10 years since Sergio came back, and when Sergio finally came back, and it really was an extraordinary contest, especially when you look at it today with all the great champions that were in that contest in 1984. So Rick wrote a really long report. So I'm going to read this whole thing at the end of our interview with Rick Wayne. So stick around for that. All right. I have some emails that I want to share with you guys. We got a lot of feedback again for the Rick Wayne interview. And if you're on YouTube, be sure to check out my video version of the interview with Rick Wayne. I've got part one and part two up there now, and I've added a lot of pictures and video clips. So it's really great to see it in a different format when you see the video part instead of just hearing the audio. So if you're on YouTube, check that out, and we'll be getting part three up there pretty soon as well. All right, so let me read some of these emails here. This one I got from Mike Dolan, who is from Lakewood Ranch, Florida. And Mike said, "Hey, John, congratulations on scoring the big interview with Rick Wayne. It's great that you have three parts to this interview. I've been listening to your podcast since you started, and I've really enjoyed all of the interviews over the years. After listening to the Rick Wayne interview, I decided to become a Patreon sponsor for this great show. When you read the comments from part one of the Rick Wayne interview, I noticed how many well-known bodybuilders commented. I would like to challenge all of the well-known bodybuilders and other longtime listeners to also become Patreon sponsors of this great show and support John for all of his hard work." Mike Dolan. All right, Mike, thank you very much. Thanks for your support on Patreon. Thanks for being a longtime listener, too. That's awesome that you've listened all 5 years since we started the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I'm glad you really enjoyed it. And thank you again for supporting us with your dollars. So I appreciate that very much. I also got this one on Apple, and it says, "Review Best Bodybuilding Podcast, the Rick Wayne interview. Oh, my God. Thanks, John." And I got some comments as well on Facebook. I mentioned it on my Facebook page, And I got a lot of comments, so let me read some of these. Corey Everson, the great Corey Everson, six-time Miss Olympia. I put a photo of Rick up, and she said, I never saw this photo. He was so ahead of his time. And Roy Callender said he sure was. And some other guy says, Stephen Godney said, I always say he was the original Muhammad Mukawe. And then Rick Wayne himself responded, and he said, Stefan, with respect, there's only ever been one Rick Wayne, not to be confused with anyone else, before or after this Rick Wayne. And Stefan replied, in all the history of bodybuilding, one anecdote that I think has been among the saddest is the fact that we never got to see you against or beat Franco at the 76 Olympia. I still have that Muscle Builder magazine where we see photos of you with your shirt around your neck. I can still see that small, defined waist. Too bad we don't have more photos of the great condition you were in that week. I remember how you described how Joe went apeshit on you, never listening, and always having to do the things your way. Remember that? And Rick said, well, let's begin with Joe going apeshit on me on any account. It never happened. As for the contest between Franco and me, we did compete. Enough said. Mario Da Silva said, great. Bill Lasevsky said, the first one was so great, I listened to it twice. Pete Fancher said, man, I could really listen to Rick Wayne talk and tell stories for days. Too bad you could have gotten him and Peter McGuff together. That would have been one hell of an interview. And Corey Everson said, or Rick and Jeff, that would have been epic. Dan Burt said, another great interview. Rick is a veritable renaissance man, like Corey said, up above, a man ahead of his time. I'm so glad you could get all these wonderful stories recorded for posterity. And then he said, also, it shouldn't be surprising, but I was kind of amazed that Rick Wayne still seems to keep his finger on the pulse of the current bodybuilding scene. He has a knack for reading the psyches of current competitors. I was 16 in 1981, and I probably learned the word perspicacious from Rick's writing. And Rick said, that's quite funny. And yes, I always try to keep my finger on whatever's happening in areas that interest me. Bob Brown said, I cannot begin to tell you how much I've enjoyed this two-part series. There is something about Rick Wayne's books and articles that puts me in the front row, witnessing these events just like I was there. In his articles, I'm sitting at the table listening to the conversations, or even one of the judges at the Olympia. His amazing vocabulary, his expertise, innate ability to know what his readers want, and sense of humor create a sense of familiarity that reading anything he writes is like a letter from a friend and sent to me. I was captivated by the stories of Arnold, Boyer, Dave Draper, and all my heroes from the golden era. I couldn't have agreed more with the comments you made about Sean Ray and Flex Wheeler. Thank you for your great effort in getting this interview, John, and for being the great interviewer and historian you are. And then Corey Everson again said, I would listen to Rick's interviews a million times. I am in such agreement with what he says, and I so enjoy these stories I've never heard. But in addition to that, his voice alone transports me right back to the days where I find myself surrounded with joy, peace, and a beautiful friendship. In a single moment, like a time traveler, I am at the Weider offices listening to Rick and Jeff playfully debate their different positions, or at a hotel venue discussing the best strategies for my advancement in the sport, or watching them seated shoulder to shoulder, front row, privately analyzing athletes' physiques. It's like yesterday, and it is wonderful. And then Lee Haney, again, came in and he said, the interview with the great Rick Wayne was nothing short of incredible. Thanks, John and Sir Rick Wayne. All right. So that was some of the comments that I got on my Facebook page and the emails you sent to me. So thank you, guys. I appreciate that again. And as for what's going on with me, I'm still working on the history of bodybuilding book, and I've been working on that every day. So working on making some progress on that so we can get it out early next year or maybe by the spring at the latest. And I am starting my diet, as I mentioned. So I'm in the process of dieting down for my birthday, the big 6-0 coming up in March. So I've got about 18 weeks left. So that process is continuing. And slow and steady wins the race, right? Okay, guys. Well, that's all I got for the opening here. So let's go to part three of our interview with Rick Wayne. This will be, unfortunately, our final interview, but I'm sure you guys are going to love it. Here we go. Hey, Rick, can you tell me how good Arnold and Sergio looked in their prime? I mean, you got to see them. You were on state. You competed with Sergio and at Mr. Universe.
Yeah,
you competed with Arnold and Mr. Universe. How good were they? I mean, just to try and give our fans or our listeners an idea.
Sergio was phenomenal. And he would have been in his best shape. Sergio would still be phenomenal.
Yeah, even today.
Because he had this tiny waist, he had the broad shoulders.
Yeah.
But the sad part is Sergio never got close to what I think he could have been. He never had those separations that he could have had.
Yeah.
And would still be able to maintain the body size.
Yeah.
You know, he never had that. And that's why I say he was blessed with this phenomenal body. But at the end of the day, Arnold, every day in a contest, I would put Arnold ahead. Because Arnold was their posing ability. Sergio had one or two shots. The shot up there, front or back, that was great.
Yeah.
Sergio's double bicep shot. Sergio did not have great biceps. There was no peak to it. There were huge arms.
Yeah.
But Arnold had a peak.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and Arnold always showed himself at best angles, the muscles that were the best, that's what you saw.
Yeah.
But Sergio just, he didn't think. Sergio didn't think. Sergio's bodybuilding had nothing to do with intellect. To beat Arnold, you had to get into his mind.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't just compete against a guy with muscles. The guy was tall. He was always impeccable. He was always on. He was funny. He knew how to work a crowd. I remember one time we were in San Jose, and that was after the Whitney Museum of Art. When you remember that thing?
Yeah.
And Arnold comes and does a show. I was in San Jose then with him. For whatever reason, I was there, and we were sharing the same suite. So there's the theater, San Jose Pictures and everything. And Arnold comes on. And of course, they went crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But Arnold, as you know, was skinny.
Yeah.
Because he had dropped all this weight for this museum thing, this, whatever it was, with Frank Zane and who was there, Ed Corney.
Ed Corney, yeah.
Et cetera. So that evening, we're in the room talking, and I said to him, Arnold, how you were so white. And you look skinny. And he says, so what? I said, so what? He said, did you feel bad standing up in front of that crowd? You know, in that kind of shape? And he said, Ricky, whose picture was outside on the billboards? You know? I said, Arnold. He said, Arnold who? I said, what do you mean Arnold? He said, Arnold who? I said, Arnold, Mr. Olympia. He said, who did the audience turn out to see? I said, Arnold. He said, stop there. did they see Arnold? I said, yeah. He said, well, they got what they came for. If they want to see me in Mr. Olympia shape, come to the Olympia.
Right.
Now, what are you going to say to that?
Right, right. That's a great idea. That's a great point.
But what are you going to say that Arnold is not going to knock himself out for a show?
Yeah, yeah.
As far as he's concerned, his name will carry him there. The Arnold fans, if he stood on his neck, they would still be applauding.
Right.
And they bought the tickets, and he's been paid.
Yeah.
It's like the famous one I wrote about him holding the envelope up to the light
in the early days.
And right. kept tossing, every now and again, he tossed the envelope into the trash. You know the story, right?
Right.
And I say to him, why are you doing that? And he says, no money, no checks. I said, but what if there is a check in there? And because he doesn't even open it. He just holds it up to the light. And I said, well, what if there's a check in there? He says, if there's a check in there, they'll call me again.
Right.
And those were early days.
I know. Amazing. So,
and Arnold did not go to any kind of a Harvard or anything.
Right.
But
right.
He didn't need to.
Yeah. Yeah.
Arnold could start his own school.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder where it came from, you know, because you look at his beginning.
I don't know.
It did come from his parents.
I know it bothered Lee. Now all these guys, it's good to see everybody friendly now. And everybody's good, but they weren't always friendly.
Yeah.
Okay. And I know Lee was not happy with how he felt the magazines were treating him as opposed to Arnold, because he felt he had won so many Olympias and he wasn't quite getting what Arnold got.
Yeah.
And he had a point, but nobody could compare themselves with Arnold. Arnold would walk into the Wheeler building where everybody knew him and what, and everybody would still come out, "Hey, Arnold." They wouldn't do it to anybody else.
Yeah.
Ferrigno would come in there, so what?
Yeah.
Even at the height of his Hulk.
Yeah, I know. There's only one Arnold.
It didn't matter. There's only one Arnold. And it's good that he's still associated with it, but the bodybuilding he represents is gone.
Yeah, I know.
Who is behind the Golden Age thing? The bodybuilding Golden Age? Who does that?
I'm not sure.
You have a page as well, haven't you?
Yeah. Bodybuilding Legends.
Oh.
I've got Bodybuilding Legends on Facebook too. Yeah.
Yeah. And Raw Iron.
Yeah, I'm part of that. Yeah.
Those are very, very good. I get so much reaction from people from all over the world, Czechoslovakia and everything.
Yeah.
From that. This is really very, very good.
Yeah.
I am reluctant to post any pictures because I don't know how, but I'm going to ask Nicole to post a few.
Because
it's so terrible. Everybody's posting, and those they post to me, sometimes I've never even seen them, but I have some unique ones.
Yeah. Send me some too, Rick.
Yeah. I'm thinking of doing another book.
That would be awesome.
And to tell the stories of behind the photographs. So I'm looking forward to that when I eventually can settle down to do that.
How was your relationship with Frank Zane? Because you guys knew each other all the way back in the 60s, and then he got a little offended when he was winning the Olympia, and you said that he was like a gazelle with the monsters, right, with the elephants and the hippos.
Yeah, but that was meant to be complimentary.
That is a compliment when you look at it, that sentence, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Frank was always upset with my writing.
He even got to the microphone in 78, remember, after he won, and he wanted to thank you. He goes, "I want to thank Rick Wayne.
Yes.
Writing all those things about me. It inspired me to train harder."
But he's gotta admit it, that what Rick Wayne, in fact, May, whenever she does interviews about how we met and whatever, she would be saying, the thing about Rick is everybody wanted Rick to write about them, because when Rick wrote about you, people read it.
Yeah.
And that's the point.
Yeah.
Look at how you've been able to just think of all those things I've forgotten.
Yeah. All those
because
articles,
each of them. I've got to also put another plug for Jack. He's not doing too well as far as I know.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I don't want to exaggerate that, but I think he has some problems. But yeah. Jack was a great, really great writer.
Yeah,
and some of the stuff I would like to tell you, I can't tell you on that because the bit near the X line.
Okay.
You didn't ask me about Mike Mensah.
I was going to.
How long is this show? Are you going to cut that up in 3 episodes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you too about Serge Nubre. We were talking about apartheid in South Africa, and that's, you wrote a big thing about that, right? About he was going over there. He was the vice president. Can you explain that a little bit, Rick? Serge was the vice president, and then all of a sudden, Weider kicked him out because he said he was in these porno movies.
Yeah, I thought they were the Weiders were not nice to Serge Nubre.
Yeah,
and but it was illustrated. There was this contest where that iconic picture was taken, that same session.
Okay.
And Draper had posed. No, he hadn't posed. Draper came, and Draper was Joe's boy. Before Arnold, there was Draper.
Yeah.
There was Sergio, Larry Scott.
Yeah.
And all those guys.
Chuck Sipes.
Yeah. Chuck Sipes didn't belong in that picture. He ran. He just ran. And when the shot was taken, I don't think all the shots have Chuck Collaris in them. Chuck Sipes, he said.
So you're talking about the group picture? Okay.
I didn't really know Chuck Sipes at all. I guess it was not one of my favorite bodybuilders either. But at that time, that iconic picture was taken. Draper said he Sergio and Draper and the rest of them were grumbling together.
Mm-hmm.
And Arnold was instigating a lot of that. make sure you get paid and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. And those were early days. So when it came time for Draper to pose, who knew Joe Weider forever, he wouldn't pose until Joe gave him a check.
Yeah.
And just says, what the hell? You know, I'll send you a check. He said, I want my check now. And that went on with two or three other guys. And Joe had no checkbook, as usual, and certainly no cash. And the guy who normally did carry that was a guy called John Lima, and he wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. So,
because Joe normally sent the checks out maybe late, but he normally sent checks out to the guys. But now they wanted to paid before they posed, and Caruso is waiting there.
Yeah.
And, of course, I've been listening to Arnold stirring it up with these guys.
Why was he doing that?
It's coming. It's coming. So it's a mess now because he doesn't have the money, Joe, and the guys won't trust him, etc. And Arnold says, "Oh, I have the money. I will." So there was Arnold's Olympia money,
mm-hmm.
and he had other money. He gave it to Joe, and Joe paid. Now you know. I tell you afterwards. It's as if Joe had met the Blessed Virgin. Arnold, such a nice guy. And it never occurred to him that Arnold had set up this whole thing.
Yeah.
And Dave was going through one of his, you know.
Yeah.
And so, unforgettable. Wow. That's Arnold again. We keep going back to him.
Yeah, you know, we do. Yeah.
The goody things, the twisted things, the clever things, the manipulative things. That is Arnold. But that was a personality.
Yeah.
All of the, whereas most of the other guys was what you see, what you get. That's it. Nothing more.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about Serge in that 75 Olympia.
Yeah. I thought Serge got
screwed.
He was an easy, he was a lamb before lions.
Because he promoted the 71 Olympia, and then he was president. So he was in favor with them for a while, and then all of a sudden they just got him out.
You remember when they banned so many guys, IFBB banned them, including Arnold, and Arnold's ban lasted until the next Olympia?
You're right. Was that 71 too, right? When they went unopposed? Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I never figured why they suspended Franco. I never did figure out what he did.
I don't remember what he did. I think he may have appeared on some unsanctioned show. But he too, the ban was just long enough for him to be available for the next contest.
Right.
Because those guys competed once a year.
Yeah, right.
So all you had to do was make the ban last from one contest to the next.
Do you think Arnold would have beat Bill Pearl if he would have been allowed in the 71 Olympia or 71 NABBA Universe?
No.
You don't think he would have beat him? No?
No.
Hmm.
But Arnold would not have entered the contest. It's like, that was a whole bunch of stuff. Oscar Heidenstam had John Grumek, first of all, as God. Reeves should have beaten Grumek. How the hell could and I mean, Grumek... Grumek is a legend, and it's almost what I'm looking for, blasphemous to say anything not wonderful about Grumek.
Right.
But, I mean, really, there are a couple of nice shots, really good shots of Grumek, I agree.
Yeah.
But Grumek was never worthy of that legend.
Yeah. They had his image as the backdrop, right, for the NABBA universe.
Yeah. And he won based on trick performances, like pulling in his gut and putting in a ball there.
I read that. It was crazy.
Yeah. Or like Reeves was, you know, when I talk to people about Reeves, I wrote something on Facebook on that recently. A guy saw somebody actually describe, he was not an English speaking person. So he used the word beautiful as a non-English speaking person. And I said, I like that because whenever I talk about Reeves, whether to young people or school, I always referred to Reeves as beautiful. And that was my first real inspiration was Steve Reeves.
Yeah.
Reeves was not handsome. Reeves was pretty beautiful. Yeah. Oh, God.
Right.
I mean, you look at some of the pictures that because now they're releasing all kinds of things and you see, well, but the pictures that we knew, well, perfection.
Yeah.
Shame walking down that on that movie set. That one with the sword and lean over.
Those pictures.
Nobody can take that. That face.
Yeah.
And that face, those bones. Oh, and it was tall. And they were everything.
Yeah.
Funny thing happened. I was a reader, and I got a call once, and said, "This is Rick Wayne. This is Steve Reeves." I said, "Yeah, right." I said, "No, this is Steve Reeves, and I'm a big fan of your writing." And I've decided I want to do a book, and I want you to write it.
Hmm.
And when you think of it, and here was my God.
Yeah.
I never did get to meet him. We talked a while. I took notes and all that kind of stuff, and he died.
Oh, yeah.
So I never got to meet him. And which is perhaps a good thing, because the image I had of him was 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, you're 80 or something. So
it's
like I had an opportunity to meet Elvis, and by that time he was gone. He was, I just didn't want to. I'm the ultimate Elvis Presley fan.
Oh yeah, okay.
Oh man. but if I was going to see him at all, I wanted to see him at the time of Vegas. And King Creole, not
at the older Elvis. Yeah. Did you see that movie, Rick, about Elvis, the new one?
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I thought it was good. I thought
everybody thinks it's good, but yeah. I can't help thinking that nothing I would see would take the place of Elvis, because I mean Elvis was the guy who I was gaga over as a teen.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying? So you don't forget.
You were a singer too.
That's right.
Yeah.
And all of my reviews said how much I sounded like Elvis.
Really? Wow.
Every record review I had.
How long did that career last?
About 5 years.
Okay.
I recorded for CBS. They had an affiliate. Yeah. And also a company called Pi.
Okay. What kind of singing was it? What kind of song?
Oh, rock. From Don't Be Cruel to King Creole.
No kidding.
All that. And Jerry Lee Lewis, a whole lot of shaking going on. Okay. That was my kind of stuff.
And you sang at one of Bud Parker's shows, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Oh, there's another one. We were in Philadelphia, and I emceed. I did a few things on the show, and I sang. And I remember I closed the first half with that Buddy Holly song, It Doesn't Matter Anymore. Mm-hmm. But I guess it doesn't matter anymore. And Leroy Corbett and all the guys in the front row—they've never heard me sing before. And wow! So I get off the stage, and as I'm walking to Joe Wheeler and all of them in the front row, they're all excited, you know. And Joe is just like that, you know.
What?
So I shook hands with the guys. Congrats, Ricky! You're great. Blah 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 blah. And then I sit down with Joe. I said, "What's the problem, Joe?" He says, "Ricky, you know how many guys would like to write like you? A lot. You know how many guys wish they had your physique? A lot. You remember? You know how many guys wish this, wish that? You know. And you can do all of those things. And I'm thinking there's a compliment coming there.
Yeah.
It's no wonder you're so fucked up." I miss Joe Wheeler. I really miss Joe. I think I probably would have come back to California if Joe, if you know, but it happens. But what is the buzz on body? Because you remember how it used to be in the old days. What is the buzz now? What do people talk about?
Well,
the fact that you have no more magazines as such, it's horrible. Because there was nothing like holding that magazine.
Oh yeah, I know.
Yeah, you know about that.
You know what? Now, Rick, with the internet, I see what happens. I even told Jake Wood, who owns the Olympia. He's the guy who bought the Olympia.
Yeah.
He's had me do. I've been doing a backstage interview. Sean Ray got me involved doing that. So I've been doing that the last couple of years when it was.
Sean seems to have opened up a whole vista. He's everywhere.
He is, yeah. He travels every week.
He's doing well, is he?
Yeah, he's a good businessman. He's involved with a lot of different companies. So
yeah, go ahead.
So I mentioned to Jake or somehow got word to Jake that it's a shame that we don't have these articles anymore. You know, like you used to do, like Peter used to do, like Jack used to do, where it would be three parts and you could read all the things of, like you said, you would go backstage, you would interview all these guys, you would find out where they're coming from and what's going on with them and what their thoughts are. And all that's gone now. Now today, because there's no magazines, there's no written account of these contests. So what happens now is when the contest happens, it's live streamed. So everybody sees it right away. And then right after it's over, everybody does their podcast or their YouTube interviews. You know, everybody talks about it for a day or so, and then it's gone, you know, and then it's like, what's going to happen next year? You know, it's
that, that can never match the idea of how we did it. How I did it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like I told you, I went after the soul. I went after, and you could keep that forever.
You
were like a walking library.
Yeah, because I got them. I still got the magazine.
That's right. With what's happening now, 2 days and it's gone.
Yeah.
And in any case, there is not the facility of asking questions. And if you want, call them back a little later and to get a little something added.
Right.
It's what they tell you backstage. And I don't know that the guys are even concentrating on what, you know, get it over with quickly backstage. They, you know, they're hungry and all.
Yeah.
It cannot replace the magazines. And I don't understand why is it there isn't a magazine? Does that mean it will not be bought?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because everything's on the internet
is taking over. Wow.
Yeah.
Very sad.
It is. It's really sad because we don't get that writing. We don't get the details of the contest.
Like lying in a lounge chair near a pool with a report of the Olympics.
Yeah.
You keep it there and you don't even read it until Saturday.
Yeah, like Joe. Yeah.
You know,
right.
Yeah.
Right. I know. And then it's bad with history too, because I'm working with Lee Haney now. He's got his own personal training certification program. And he's complaining about the history. He's like, nobody knows the history. These young kids don't know the history. So he wants me to put something together that I could teach at his certification course about the history of bodybuilding, something short, you know, and it'll give him a little bit of background about the history of bodybuilding. But if you go look like at a contest, like at last year's Mr. Olympia, and you go to look up a report on it or something, it'll list who won and it'll have the top 10. But that's it. There's no article.
Like I watch the guys on podcasts like yours. I think Gasparri,
yeah.
Lee Haney. And they're interesting for me to hear Lee Haney's perspective on something. But it's more a matter of everybody being nice to everybody.
Yeah, right.
That's not real life.
Yeah, I know.
That is not real life. I remember doing a color thing in Europe, where was it? Geneva, with Jeff Everson. There was this big contest with Jeff Everson. And Jeff was saying how, in his commentary, we were doing color commentary, and there was put pay-per-view in Los Angeles and all this stuff. And for Jeff, who was a wonderful guy, by the way, and very good writer.
Yeah.
Very good writer.
Yeah, I like Jeff too.
Yeah, very. I miss him. His magazine. I love this magazine as well. And everybody was wonderful. Isn't it, Rick? Isn't it? And at one point, I said, come on, Jeff. the guy's crap. I said, and I was told that in Los Angeles they lifted the roof.
Oh, really?
That the guy was crap, and somebody said it. And
yeah.
Just it's going to be Rick Ward who's going to say it, you know?
Yeah. So,
but I think that actually made the particular show his star. But today, guys, everybody's nice to each other.
I know.
And that's not real life. I watch Gasparri, and Gasparri says how wonderful he was. They talk about their workouts.
Yeah.
They talk about their workouts. Or like Makawi. Makawi is another one people know very little about.
Yeah.
I had left California on one of my hiatuses to St. Lucia. And I was at this newspaper, working at this newspaper, and an envelope on my desk sent to me from WIDA, from California. And as I opened it, a bunch of pictures fell out. And I said, hell, when did I take those pictures? And then I read the letter, company letter, and it was Makawi telling me how everybody in Egypt, they call him Little Rick Wayne.
Oh, yeah. But, I remember that.
But it looked, I mean, the poses were my poses, and he really did
Yeah.
You can still see it, you know.
Even facially, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think he was fantastic, by the way. And I don't think it enough is known about Muhammad. Muhammad went up against giants, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I've tried to get him on my show, and for some reason he doesn't want to do interviews.
He doesn't want to do interviews.
Yeah, yeah.
Probably disenchanted.
Yeah, yeah, maybe.
He's in Canada, isn't he?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
That's why I last saw him. Yeah, yeah. He beat Henny, didn't he? In one of the Grand Prix.
A couple, like three of them, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Because I was there. Yeah, yeah. Bertle Fox.
Yeah, we got to talk about Bertle Fox.
You know,
before we get into that, though, about the articles, Rick, I wanted to say that when I was talking about the 81 Olympia report, what so impressed me was you had these quotes in there from Joe Weider. He was talking about Arnold, saying Arnold's bad at this and Arnold's bad at that. And then Arnold was criticizing Joe Weider, saying, oh, Joe's such an actor. He wouldn't come up on stage. Like, he was so surprised about this.
That was the biggest booing contest.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But Arnold,
I was just so impressed that you guys were able to put that in the magazine. It was so enjoyable to read that, you know. And I was like, I'm really
impressed that Joe Weider
allowed that in, you know.
Joe Weider never stopped me writing.
Yeah.
I told you about the Pope, right, thing. I told you about that.
Yeah.
Before. Yeah. Joe Weider has never stopped me writing in it.
Yeah.
And so all the talk, that's why I always defend him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that Joe Weider had a special disc. Everybody has their favorites. I had my favorite guys.
I don't think that would ever be allowed now. Like, you could not criticize the organization, the judges, you know, they would cut that. They would never be allowed.
I did.
I know.
I criticize judges. I criticize.
Oh, great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I criticize the fact that you have the same judges all the time. I still see they're complaining about that.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of stories also not told regarding Arnold's Australia, which I won't do this time. Next time we'll do that.
All right. Yeah.
Some interesting things have never been told, because I interviewed Arnold about that contest.
And he
really was pouring out his feelings and what really happened and who screwed him.
Oh, wow. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And who owed him money. And he says, well, one particular judge came to him and said, Arnold, I'm sorry. But you know, it's tough. Well, the guy's got to do what the guy's got to do. And Arnold says to him, you owe me so much. I want my money right now. And the guy said, well, the guy's got to do what the guy's got to do. And he demanded that the money the guy owed him. I won't say the name right now. And got his money back. Arnold was devastated by the whole thing. I met him in Philadelphia a few weeks earlier. I just come back for them. I think it was the first Miss Olympia.
Miss Olympia, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have a lot of pictures on that. You may have seen some of those pictures. Yeah. And I said, are you competing? Nah, I'm just training. And the next thing I heard, Arnold was on his way.
Yeah.
I think he was in good shape, but he was not, Arnold.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like boxing. When a guy is a world champion and has been for a while, you have to knock him out.
Mm-hmm.
You can't beat him on points.
Yeah.
You basically have to knock him out. And Arnold was not knocked out.
Yeah.
But a lot of stuff followed that, because he had, remember, he staged the contest that Franco was in. The booing, really booing, that was his contest.
Yes.
And he was scared the death of all the guys would boycott.
Yeah. Yeah.
And didn't. So when he was laughing and all the remarks, it did not all necessarily have to do with what everybody saw, but almost a revenge kind of thing. Everybody's on my case about Australia. Well, now talk about this.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you wish you would have went to that, Rick, the 1980 Olympia, to see it in person?
Australia?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. you know that was one of my – I hated traveling. See, that was the other thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I said to Joe, I want to cover that, he would have settled that right away. As a matter of fact, I did not go back to Los Angeles. I stayed with George Snyder for almost a year writing
– Oh, really?
Three More Reps.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those are great books.
Yeah, yeah. I was writing Three More Reps.
Yeah.
And Those are good books, actually.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I read a lot of nice comments about them. So yeah. I couldn't have gone anywhere. But if I'd had a choice, I would have loved God. Yeah. I would have had everything that went down. Every book,
yeah.
Right?
Oh yeah, you would have been right into that.
Yeah, but all you read now is just rumor and perspective, and
it's amazing it's still talked about. I mean, 42 years later.
Yeah, but not with any meat.
No,
they just
no.
Say,
talked about by people who weren't even born when it happened.
Exactly. Or they say Mensa should have won and whatever.
Yeah. Let's talk about Bertel Fox, because he was a favorite of yours, right? When he first came.
Not much to say about Bertel. I remember when it happened. I called Joe and I told Joe about it, and he said, "What a shock!"
Yeah,
but we're not surprised, are we? Because all the signs were there.
Yeah.
Enough said.
Yeah. What about him as a bodybuilder, Rick? Because you liked him when he first came over, right? You were a big supporter of him.
I have said also, if I have any regrets, is that I ever talked Bertel into coming to California, because he never wanted to. And in fact, before I came back to California, George tried every inducement and he wouldn't bite, because Bertel enjoyed being the big fish in a small pond.
Yeah.
He didn't. Bertel did not like competing.
Mm, yeah.
That's why he went to New York, and Bertel and Beckles and Fuller and all those guys blew him away, psyched him out.
Yeah.
He hated them. Bertel loved working out. Bertel would come to my place, in which was very close, 5 minute walk from where I got him an apartment, and his wife, very close to where I lived in Canoga Park.
Mm-hmm.
And Bertel would come to my place, depressed as hell. How can he get out of this Olympia? How can he get out of this? He's a contract to Joe, but looking for excuses. If I get a doctor, to this, can I do that? And I said, what do you want to do it for? And one particular day, the guy walks into my living room, the house. And Bertel was never fat. He was always, always almost in contest shape.
Yeah.
And I took him to my bathroom and the mirror, did his shirt off, and made him pose and all of it. And was sweating from the effort. And as he put his shirt back on, walking back in the living room, he says, I don't know what it is. I don't look like that in my mirror. Speaking of which, I was at a show where what's the second name now? I forget. Steve, one of the old boys.
Davis? Not Steve Davis.
Steve Davis.
Okay.
Yeah. And Arnold and I were sitting near the stage, and Steve walks up. And Steve used to be heavy, very heavy.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, he came down to Zanish proportions.
Right.
And Arnold's sitting there, and Arnold says, always watching. Arnold was like an eagle and sight, checking everybody out. You always get back to Arnold. And he says, I would give anything to have that guy's mirror. And he was dead serious. I said, what do you mean? He says, look at how he walks. Can you just imagine what he sees in the mirror? He sees Mr. Olympia in the mirror.
Yeah.
But the other guys were the reverse, and Bertel was the reverse. Bertel was it.
Yeah.
But he couldn't see it. Bertel never got over being a little boy from St. Kitts.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure you see that with a lot of bodybuilders, right?
Yeah, all those guys. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Nobody has done anything about the psychology of the of champions. There's a book called Little Big Men or something.
Yeah.
They kind of attempted that. But nobody has done a real serious from the stage perspective of these people, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk about Mike Mentzer, Rick, before I let you go, because I know we've been talking for a while. What did you think of Mike when you first met him, when he first came on the scene?
I remember Mike came to Weider, and it's obvious that he had read a lot of my stuff, etc. And it was obvious, too, that he didn't like that I was obviously a super fan of Arnold, that we had background and all that kind of stuff. So it was very quiet, and he was always a very cerebral guy, huh? Mm-hmm. As well. So he was, Jack and him were good friends. I think Jack lived with him for a while.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Okay. And there I say that I always thought there was something odd about Mike. I did not go for his training system for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. I had gotten, you know, Larry Scott measured my arm at 20 inches.
Wow.
And I was still in England. Larry Scott measured it.
Yeah.
I have actually gotten to 21-inch arms at 215.
Wow.
And these are real measurements, real measurements. And I was not on drugs.
Wow.
Larry Scott. Arnold wrote in one of his books that Rick Wayne had the perfect, and Larry Scott said the same. Rick Wayne had the perfect upper arm balance, bicep height, and triceps.
Yeah.
Okay. So my arms came in very, I did not use heavy weights. My favorite exercise was the bent over concentration curl, which was more dynamic tension movement with a weight in my hand.
Yeah.
As opposed to straining it. I did a lot of those cheap barbell curls, but I always thought that was, I just hurt my rotator cuff and back with all the kind of, those movements were hopeless.
Yeah.
I like seated dumbbell curls, alternate, because there's a concentration. You can actually let that arm hang down and really get that arm. And the most I ever used on that was 40. You know, I didn't need anything more than 40 pounds for my arms. I would sometimes go a little more, but for my workouts, 40. And when I was ready for the Olympia, I was 195, 200, and I was cut, really cut, you know. Mm-hmm. So at my height, that's good body weight.
Yeah.
So, and I did that without any kind of heavy movements.
Yeah.
They were heavy. I counted poundages in terms of one set 12. So I would have the weight and by the time, I would need a little push maybe on the 10th rep, 11th rep. Mm-hmm. I never believed in the spotting. I think that's a whole lot of crap.
Horse drops, yeah.
Because if you have a guy helping you, what's the point of that? No matter what the help is giving you, you work to failure. In that, I use Mensah's phrase there, to failure. You know, you shouldn't be able to do another rep when you return the weight to the rack.
Yeah.
But that you can do that with a 35-pound dumbbell, or you can do it with a bench press with 300.
Yeah.
But I determined the weight based on what I was able to do with it. And always the exercises, there was this mind-muscle connection. So if I did one of my favorite movements, which I think is the best exercise for the pecs anyway, although they can have problems with your shoulders, flies,
mm-hmm.
I would go down connected and come back squeezing.
Yeah.
And if they were so heavy that I couldn't control the squeeze, that would be too heavy.
Too much, yeah.
So I use how much weight for that? Probably go up to 50, 45.
Okay, wow.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah.
But other guys were using 60.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I also loved inclined dumbbell presses.
Yeah.
Okay. And as for abdominals, crunches and leg raises between chairs, all I did, and I won best abdominals a number of times.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I actually beat Franco for best abdominals. That ain't easy. Yeah.
So, that's the world, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I got shafted in that one.
Yeah, that was on paper one, right?
but again, another iconic thing. Dave Draper handed me the trophy. He says, Rick, you deserve this trophy. And he gave me the trophy stage.
Wow, no kidding.
On stage. Great guy, Dave. He says you deserve that trophy. That famous Caruso picture with Sergio doing a double bicep and all those trophies at his feet, all my trophies.
Oh, really? No kidding.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. My trophies. Best body parts, best pose, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah,
they were all my trophies.
Mm-hmm.
So every time I see those pictures, memories.
Yeah.
I'm a great fan of good photographs.
Yeah,
and Caruso, the guy I never met was a guy called Paul Bernal or something.
Yeah, Per Bernal. Yeah.
I really wish when I was in top shape that I might have known this guy.
Yeah, he's great.
Fantastic pictures. Chris Lund also was very good. I remember asking him how he had this perspective. And he told me that he started photography, photographing cadavers, dead bodies.
Mm. Wow.
That's how he started his photography.
Wow.
And I photographed them the same way. And he photographed these bodybuilding champions with the same kind of mind, you know.
Wow. That's crazy. Hey, I want to mention Cal Scalak. Remember him?
Very much.
Yeah. And he tried to do that.
Cal was, for me, on reflection, a bit mentorish.
Okay.
I never thought Mike was a particularly friendly guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be just a personal thing with Mike and myself. We never had any fights or anything.
Okay.
But we never connected. But he connected with Jack. Jack adored him.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say he was a bad guy.
Yeah.
I just want to say that our chemistry didn't go. And when he flipped, I have to say flipped, because I would take the calls at my house.
Oh, really?
No 6 o'clock in the morning. And he would start talking the stuff of the devil. I saw the devil, and he was referring to Arnold. It took me a while to realize he's talking about Arnold. And I suspect on reflection that he may have been on substances at the time sounded like a total insane guy.
Yeah.
You know, so we never really, talented guy, he wrote well, he wrote very well. Yeah. It must have hurt him tremendously when he felt he should have beaten Arnold.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because he was convinced he should have beaten Arnold. But then Frank Zane also thought that.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I think Arnold, it's just like he said about in Germany. Had I been a judge, I might have voted for Sergio. I was not a judge, Rick. I was a contender.
Right.
And that line, I wrote about that. And that line has been given all kinds of meanings.
Yeah.
But that was Arnold's way of saying, what do you want from me? I'm there as a competitor.
Yeah.
I'm not a judge. And if the judges chose me,
that's
the way it is.
Yeah.
But you know, people tended to go after Arnold, believing that he had a deal set up with Reader, Reader manipulated the judges. That's not true.
Right.
Back there were times when Joe perhaps secretly wished Arnold wouldn't win.
Yeah.
Especially if Ferrigno. That was his baby.
Mm.
But I think he eventually sidelined him.
Yeah.
And went full blown Arnold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Cal tried to do that.
Cal.
The union.
I don't know. Well, first it was Arnold who wanted the union. Arnold had all of those guys complaining that they weren't getting enough money for the Olympia.
Right.
And so on. And Arnold took his life in his hands with the Weeders and organized this meeting in Santa Monica.
Mm-hmm.
And the place was packed. And Ben Weeder showed up and they were going to, he expected all of these guys to complain to Ben Weeder what their problems were.
Mm-hmm.
And he would be standing with them. Well, he had already told Ben anyway. And that's why Ben was there. And not one guy had a complaint. And Arnold walked out, and on his way out, Ben, don't forget my birthday party this evening. You know why he said that?
Why?
Because he was telling all those guys, screw you. My relationship with Ben is solid. You need me to talk to Ben for you, but you were too chicken to stand up for yourself, and you all made me look bad. So now I know where I stand.
So Arnold was the one who wanted the union because he had all the bodybuilders complaining to him.
That's right. That's correct. That's correct.
Yeah.
Sakalak had his problems, but I don't think Sakalak actually went anyway to form or anything. Sakalak fell out with Weeder over endorsements and whatever. I think I was a witness in the court in one of their court cases. They settled or whatever. But again, I never really got to know Sakalak. I wrote about him a couple of times.
Yeah.
But I never really got to know him. He wasn't the most affable guy I know. I mean, Zane was always very, very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Very quiet. But when I would be interviewing him, he it was a fountain of stuff coming out, like his dreams and his dreams and all that kind of stuff. It was great. A bit weird when a guy who has a dream before every Olympia and can interpret them, but great stuff for writing about.
Yeah, yeah.
And I presented him also like a bodybuilding, like an intellectual. He was a teacher, chemistry, yeah, or whatever it was. He was teaching math. Yeah. And I presented him as a guy, an intellectual, was a bodybuilder. Yeah. Because I always wanted to do that. I always wanted the world to know that these are guys who just happen to do bodybuilding. That bodybuilding did not turn you into moron.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're a moron as a bodybuilder, that's because you were a moron before you were a moron.
Right.
And it's like Robbie. Robbie was always in all kinds of different moods because of stuff Robbie was taking. You know, I have a photograph of Robbie sniffing with his then girlfriend on a plane. And that's why he couldn't be at the Olympia at the contest to check out the lighting. So there's a guy called Halpern or whatever his name is, who wrote a book on Arnold, and he writes about a pumping iron, a wrap-up party that Arnold gave on Arnold's birthday or something or other. And the guy quotes me as saying Arnold's a racist and all this and whatever. Man, I wasn't there for pumping iron. I was back in the Caribbean by then. I came back afterwards. And what he obviously did, when you read he quoted Robbie. And, you know, I read that angrily. But I laughed about it. Reminded me of the all look-alike kind of thing. And, you know, I got over that. And I thought to call the guy. You know, when I was much younger, I would have been pissed off. I'd call the publisher and everybody out.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
all of those things add up to make stories so I can talk to you about them.
But
so this writer guy totally got our names mixed up.
Yeah.
The statement came from Robbie, not from me, because I was not anywhere around for pumping iron. I didn't want to be around pumping iron. I went on vacation. I was there for pumping iron. The women attended the. I had a lot of fun writing about the premiere, where you had people like the woman who was the feminist who was in charge. I forget the name now.
Gloria Steinem.
Gloria Steinem.
Yeah,
I met her. Very nice. George Plimpton, who was a great writer, and I was a great author of his books. I'd met him earlier in Vegas. I talked to Corey a lot. And talk to her about Bev and all these people. Have you ever contacted her?
Yeah, we did an interview about a year ago. She was great. Great person.
Yeah. She was a lot of fun. I think she's still very shook up.
Yeah, she was. Jeff. Yeah.
And I pull a leg all the time. I say, you have a phenomenal husband, because I don't know any other husband would allow you to keep that flame burning as open as that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but maybe the guy figures, well, he's dead anyway.
Yeah. I felt bad in the interview, because the first thing I said to her was, I'm sorry about Jeff passing. I think he passed at least 6 months, maybe a year ago. She started crying.
Yeah. Yeah. She's still very much in love
with him. Yeah.
Oh, it's very much in love with him.
Yeah.
And they were so good together.
Yeah. Yeah.
The articles I wrote, very funny articles about Jeff. There was one in particular, Jeff in the doghouse.
Yeah.
And he posed for this picture with a poodle and a little thing. And, you know, Jeff had a great sense of humor. As they say in England, a good stirrer-upper as well. He used to stir it up between me and Fred Hatfield.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I'll save that for another show.
Okay. What about Ken Waller? Did you get to meet him pretty good?
Yeah. But those guys were the, Gold's Gym, people,
yeah.
And I never moved from Vince's. I enjoyed working at Vince's.
Okay.
And again, we'll talk about Vince. Like nobody has talked about Vince next time.
Okay.
What a nice, humble, crazy nutcase. But we were very, very close. And funny thing, Bobby Blake.
Yeah.
O.J. Simpson. And I worked out together for about 4 years.
Wow, really?
At Vince's.
Yeah.
And the stories I can tell you about that.
That'll be interesting.
Must wait for another show.
Okay.
But those are things you won't read anywhere else, including not in those books. What's his name? Coyle?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's been writing on Vince's. But, you know, you read those things, and Vince was iconic, but Vince was also weird.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and
you were out there a long time, right? Rick?
Long time, and he loved me.
Did he?
He loved me. Yeah. As I introduced myself, this is never going to end. As I introduced, I just come to California a week. I get a phone call in my office. Is this Rick Wayne? I said, yeah. It says, well, I'm Vince Gironda. And I say, wow, because iconic. I'd seen him in London and all that stuff. And he says, I'm calling you and I'm drunk. And the reason I'm drunk is I couldn't talk to you unless I was drunk. But of course, you know, he had a serious alcoholic problem anyway. But he let me know he was drunk, and he had gotten drunk for Dutch courage, as they say in England.
Right.
So he had called me and he says to me, do not embarrass me. I have sent your keys to you by courier, and he'll be delivering it any minute. And if you turn me down, I will be very, very embarrassed because I've been talking about you. In other words, don't go training at goals. Right, and the great thing about Vince's gym,
he sent you keys to his gym.
Is that what he sent me the keys, yeah.
Wow,
But you know, Vince's gym was like a home gym.
Yeah.
It was very archaic. When you got to know your way around, great.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of great things Vince had, but there were also things that were quirky.
Yeah.
And if you wanted to do that, go ahead and do it. But crap. Like his aversion to squats and sissy squats. I can't think of anything to hurt your knees more than,
right.
More than sissy squats. But if he ever saw a guy squatting in there were no squat racks.
Right.
And if he ever caught anybody squatting, he'd throw you out.
Right.
He'd go to the register, get your money, and I've seen him do that so many times.
Wow, crazy.
Vince Gironda. But there's so much to tell. I didn't.
I know.
You really set it going.
Great.
So I was talking about OJ, Bobby Blake, and a few others. And
Carl Weathers?
Carl Weathers.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of pictures.
It's great talking to you, man. you remember everywhere I slip up.
Good.
And he loved Carl Weathers as well.
Yeah.
Carl Weathers. And one day, one of those hot, really hot and sweaty California days. So it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And we all had keys, by the way. Mm-hmm. So we could train anytime.
Mm-hmm.
And all those guys were movie stars and actors or people in fashion. Those are the people who worked out at Vince as the regulars, as opposed to people who came up. So Vince's hair all the way down. He just came in. He's hungover from that. He had a very, very serious alcohol problem. You know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And plus, funny Italian. You know, Vince was a joy. You can tell I loved him. So we're sitting there. A couple of guys were in fashion. They were the first to come up with that kind of shirt where you just tied the at the neck, and mm-hmm. and they were just loose. Those guys, their name, Golden somebody. They created that, and it was fashionable for a long time. Anyway, so, and then it became gear for working out in. So we're sitting in the bathroom, the shower section, Vince, myself, a couple of the other guys, and a couple of old boys, Italian friends of his. And OJ comes out of stark naked, out of showers, and he has a towel on his shoulder. And OJ is in great shape. I mean, he wasn't limping then. Great. OJ was a good looking guy. I mean, he's a nice guy. And just then, Robert Blake, whom everybody hated, is coming from the gym into the shower area where we were sitting.
Okay.
Sweating like a pig, and Dick wouldn't talk to anybody. Horrible guy.
Yeah.
And Vince, out of nowhere, just says, Bobby, why couldn't you be like a half as nice as OJ instead of being such a fucking asshole? And Blake's response was, that was it. They will use that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But the punchline there, I met OJ in Miami. I was back in St. Lucia and I was doing a trip and I had to change planes in Miami.
Okay.
And May was going up the stairs with an editor I had. I thought you were going to Turks and Caicos. Right? So they were going up the escalator, they doing a little shopping, and I got a whole bunch of magazines, and I'm sitting down by myself looking at the magazines, and then I lift my head up, and I can see May pointing, not pointing, but obviously attracted to something up there. So with the woman she's with. So I looked up in the direction, and there's something about it that your eye, which is supposed to send the message to the brain, I don't know, but the eye seems to see, to register before the brain. You know?
Right.
You know? So I turn, I look down like this, you know. It's OJ. So I dropped the magazines. Forget I trained this guy 5 years straight, 4 or 5 years. And so he sees me and he shouts, Rick Wayne! And there we are. And I was still working out, pretty big still.
Yeah.
And now these two big guys hugging each other. Right. And everybody suddenly realizes this is OJ Simpson, yeah, who supposedly had an accomplice in that whole nastiness.
Okay.
So I dropped him right there. So
yeah.
We start talking. And I start saying to him, about this guy, I said, what is it? I said, OJ, what is it, man? Carl had problems with a woman, his wife. I didn't go into too much detail. He knew.
Yeah. He said,
Bobby Blake and his wife, whatever. And you, what is it? and he laughed. And he says, did I see his interview with ABC or some station out in LA where he talked about Bobby Blake? I said, no, I didn't see that. So he tells me, well, I said, if Bobby Blake is watching right now, I hope he's not as stupid as I was and he keeps his mouth shut. And I figured,
wow.
Oh my God, time to end this conversation.
Yeah.
Because the last thing I would have wanted if I were Blake at the time was to have OJ endorsing anything for me or telling me what I should do.
Right, in a murder case.
So that's the last I saw. But all of these are roots for, it was a great place because all these movie stars were, everybody was there.
Yeah.
Bobby Blinn, who did Roots, all of these guys were there.
Yeah,
the Monsters, all these people were there. Very, very nice story. So that'll wait for next time.
Okay.
It's been a great nostalgic trip.
It has, Rick.
And you are the ideal host.
Thank you.
Because you really researched your subject. And I think it has a lot to do with love of the sport.
It has, yeah.
And we got to keep it going.
All right, absolutely.
So if I die tomorrow, well, at least there's something. You got something.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I can't thank you enough for doing this, Rick. I'm glad we finally got a chance to do it.
I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, we'll do it again sometime, okay?
We have a lot of stories. We have a lot of other stories I'd like to put on record.
All right.
Yes. I look forward to that. Okay. Hi, John.
Thank you, Rick. I appreciate it. Take care.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you again to Rick Wayne for this great interview. We really enjoyed it, not just myself, but all the people that listen to the show. So hopefully, as Rick said, we can talk to him again in the near future. We've got a lot more to talk about. He sounds like he's got a lot more stories to tell. So keep your fingers crossed that we can do that again in the near future. I want to thank my Patreon donors for helping to support the show every week. I could not do the show without you guys. So thank you to all of you who help support the show. And again, if you're interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor, just go to bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. That's our official website. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link to become a Patreon donor. All right. And if you guys are interested in any online training, I am still working for prophysique.com. I have the link for that in the description. Or just go to prophysique.com and click on the coaches page and you'll see my picture there if you're interested in getting any help with your workouts or your diet. All right, guys, let me read this article. This comes from the March 1985 issue of Flex Magazine. It's a great article
about the 1984 Mr. Olympia contest written by our guest, Rick Wayne. The title of the article is Now the Real Story of the 84 Mr. Olympia. It's Haney, Bug Squasher, Extraordinaire. Sergio's coming back. It started as a self-conscious whisper, barely audible above the hollow, pompous, puffy pitches of former lucky winners gone mad, returning retirees, whistlers in the dark, and sundry self-advertisers, not to mention fantasy mongers bored out of their tight little minds with the concept of ballet prancers as new heroes of the Olympia. Sergio's coming back. Through June, July, and August, the rumor survived, sustained by pessimistic thousands who for almost a decade had been saying that since Arnold's departure, the Big O, once 10 cuts above the rest, had transmogrified into a pathetic, toothless lion, all roar and no bite, a fantasy island farce for pretend gladiators and closet eaters of quiche. But some of us knew better than to swallow that Sergio line. We smiled our most inscrutable smiles, well acquainted as we were with the legend of the myth. Sergio coming back? No way. Since his 1970 defeat by Arnold in New York, Sergio has made a career of castigating the IFBB and its founders. At nearly every turn, he flouted the Federation's laws. In London, he competed in an unsanctioned event against Bill Pearl, lost, and found himself suspended for 1 year by the IFBB. Then came his inexplicable defeat by Arnold in Germany. The victor credited the wall paint at the venue. After which, well, Sergio just seemed to lose touch with reality. 2 weeks before a scheduled 1974 Mr. Olympia appearance in New York, Sergio and Arnold collided in Tijuana. The result? A Mexican standoff so noisome that the IFBB saw fit to suspend show promoter Eddie Sylvester and Arnold's tormentor for life. Of course, that was hardly that. Soon after their south of the border fandango, Sergio and Arnold crossed wrists yet again, this time refereed by Tom Snyder, bodybuilding's two leading men went for each other's guts. Sergio swinging wildly with vicious intent, caring not one bit whose sensitive ego got in the way. Arnold deftly parrying while millions of insomniac late-night TV addicts looked on incredulously. Naturally, the IFBB was outraged. One muscle builder barrage after another was fired in self-defense. And if the truth be told, Sergio caught a few in the rear. Safe behind their nom de plume, reckless scribes described him as, quote, a chicken without a head, unquote, and much worse. As I say, those of us who were not born yesterday and knew the full story of Sergio's rise and fall paid scant attention to the comeback story. A long time ago, we had convinced ourselves that the IFBB had seen the last of Sergio Oliva. The official word set us right. Sergio had publicly announced his intention to compete in the 84 Mr. Olympia, scheduled for November 3rd at the Felt Forum in New York. In its usual democratic fashion, the IFBB had decided to first consult loyal supporters, including regular Mr. Olympia contenders, on the question of the prodigal son's return to the fold. Sergio's IFBB future would depend on the majority vote. World's Gym Joe Gold, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Armad Tani, and several of the confirmed 84 Mr. Olympia contestants received letters soliciting their vote on the Sergio matter. Gold expressed regret that there had been need to keep one of bodybuilding's greatest superheroes out of the IFBB picture, even for 1 minute, let alone 11 years. Arnold agreed, as indeed did the canvas contestants, all except Bertel Fox, who insisted that Sergio be forced to pay the price of his disloyalty over the years. Not that the thought of facing Sergio in New York bothered Bertel. After all, he had gone up against Sergio once before in Paris. And even though Bertel had been forced to eat crow on that occasion, that didn't mean he was scared witless to the thought of a second encounter. Of course not. Fox was no chicken. Samir Benoot, who had won the 83 Olympia, showed no signs of fear. Somehow, he remained calm when someone suggested that Samir's ambition to win the title in 84 and four more times thereafter was in danger now that Sergio had apparently re-entered the Mr. Olympia picture. Averred Samir, if Sergio comes in as big and cut as he was when he faced Arnold in Essen, then it's all over for everyone else in New York. Of course, Samir didn't for 1 minute believe that anyone could at age 50-something pull off such a feat, not even Sergio. In September, Wayne D'Amelia, who with New York gym owner and longtime IFBB booster Julie Levine would produce the 84 Mr. Olympia, taped for the December issue of this magazine an interview with Sergio. The star interviewee confirmed that, yes, he would be among the contenders on November 3rd. Why? Well, past problems with the IFBB notwithstanding, bodybuilding had remained his first love. The fans had never stopped clamoring for his return. And since his physique was now in better shape than it had been 10 years earlier, he figured, what the heck? 1984 is as good a time as any to reclaim my Mr. Olympia title. Besides, there was a little matter of the prize money, $100,000. Three Mr. Olympia victories in 1967, 68, and 69 had brought Sergio the grand sum of $3,000. If he won in 84, he would take home almost 20 times that amount. Oh, yes, indeed. A big if, but one most definitely worth gambling on. Between sets at World Gym, a transformed 255-pound Lee Haney read Sergio's short interview and smiled. 2 weeks earlier at Weider headquarters in Woodland Hills, Lee had aimed a banana-sized forefinger at a visiting Samir Benoot and growled, "See that little bug? I'm going to squash him in New York." And the incumbent hero had shied away in disbelief. Now at World Gym, it seemed the last thing Lee wanted to do was squash anybody. When somebody asked what he thought about Sergio's comeback decision, Lee just shook his head and without one word went back to work on the heavy-duty lap machine. He got the feeling right then that come November 3rd, Lee would do what he had to be done in New York, but that there'd be no joy in the undoing. I tried to communicate with Sergio on the matter of his resurrection. Oh, many times. He proved beyond reach. Said his wife, Arlene, "Sergio's asleep," or "You just missed him," or "I'll tell him you called. Maybe he'll call back." And of course, he didn't. Arlene assured me that her husband was doing fine, never mind the pictures in Bob Kennedy's Muscle Mag that suggested Sergio had turned into a 260-pound butterball. Was Sergio perturbed by the stories concerning Lee Haney, Casey Viator, Bertel Fox, Chuck Williams, ostensibly among the leading lights of the 84 Mr. Olympia? Certainly not. Au contraire, Sergio fully anticipated the triumphant return. I formed the opinion that my old friend no longer wished to confide in me, that he no longer trusted me. After all, more than 5 years had passed since our last meeting. What's more, I had for several years been close to the Weider organization. How could Sergio know for certain what I had caught? Meanwhile, Bertel Fox had split. He escaped to friendly territory, far away from California, World Gym, and Golds, where such opposition dragons as Lee Haney, Tom Platt, Samir Benoot, and Bob Paris made the atmosphere unbearable. A big fish at home only in small ponds, Bertel had fled to Germany, where 1 year earlier he prepared for his second Mr. Olympia assault. Germany, where he had friends genuine enough to have stood up and booed for close to 5 minutes at the announcement that all their hero had managed was fifth place. Moreover, Bertel had learned not to trust himself on home ground. In California, contest be damned, he tended to succumb to the excessive dictates of his notoriously indiscriminate appetite. In Germany, on the other hand, he was constantly surrounded by sycophants who worshipped the ground he sweated on. Opportunities to pig out were almost non-existent. Circumstances forced him to stick with his pre-contest diet. Bertel's 1984 plan was to train away from home until 3 days before the Mr. Olympia and then move to New York, where Kim awaited with home comforts. Ah, but the plan went awry. 3 weeks before the contest, Bertel sneaked back to L.A., by all accounts a changed man. Sider swore he couldn't have weighed more than 180 pounds. That now Bertel was but a shadow of the man he'd been when he left for Germany, the man who had weighed 240-something. What diabolical regimen could he have endured in Deutschland? What suicidal masochism? He took no phone calls. Investigators were told by Kim that her husband was awaiting the results of medical tests before deciding whether or not to show his now ferret face in New York. Yes, yes, with less than 2 weeks before the 84 Mr. Olympia, the one that Bertel had sworn to win. Well, catastrophe. The ritual meeting of the IFBB judges and contestants on the eve of the Mr. Olympia started promptly at 7:30 p.m., according to schedule, on the second floor of the Doral Inn on Lexington Avenue. I arrived a quarter of an hour late, as was duly noted by Hawkeye Ben Weider, with Lee Haney in tow. Little did the IFBB president know that his speech was being taped, that in my own time I would refer to all that was said in my absence. Nevertheless, I was in time to hear Ben say, "I know that this contest represents a critical part in the life of the professional bodybuilders who are here this evening. The IFBB has taken every precaution to select the judges with utmost care and attention and consideration to assure that everyone gets justice, fair judging, and no favoritism based on stupidity. He said that the IFBB had spared no expense to ensure impartiality. Wayne D'Amelio had been mandated to verify and scrutinize every round of the judging. There would be 7 judges and 2 alternates. Any judge found wanting would be immediately removed from the Mr. Olympia panel and replaced by an alternate. Naturally, after the contest, there would be some disappointed people, but they would not be able to blame their disappointment on the IFBB. After all, the IFBB had spared no effort and expense in search for the most experienced and competent judges. Ben Weider assured everyone present that it makes no difference to my brother Joe and me who wins tomorrow night. As he had done several times at similar occasions, he pointed out that it was literally impossible to fix the Mr. Olympia or any other IFBB event. At the conclusion of his speech, the president of the IFBB called on the contestants to express any disagreement with the choice of the judges. Nobody spoke up. The meeting was over. Bob Paris, Samir Banute, Charles Glass, Chuck Williams, Bob Birdsong, Robbie Robinson, Hubert Metz, Appy Steenbeck, Bill Grant, Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, Yosef Wilkosh, Lee Haney, Tony Pearson, and Mohammed Makawe took turns dipping for the numbers that would establish the order of appearance at the next day's big event. Sergio was the last to dip, and he came up with the number 1. God, he grimaced. That means I'm going to be the first on stage. Mama. I reminded him twice that Frank Zane had picked number 1, and each time he'd been declared Mr. Olympia. Ah, said Sergio, smiling. He'd been the first, after Ben Weider, to acknowledge my presence on the second floor of the Doral Inn. He'd offered his hand and suggested we talk after the meeting. Finally, it was as if nothing had changed. We hugged. I felt his enormous deltoids and arms through the thin fabric of his gym jacket. I wished him luck. He said he was in better shape than ever before, better than he'd been for his last outing against Arnold, when nearly everyone said Sergio was out of this world. And maybe because he caught something in my eyes, a little doubt perhaps, pulled me aside, lifted the front of his jacket just high enough to expose his midriff. Check this out, he said, pointing to his flexed abdominals. Veins and cuts popped up everywhere. Franco Colombo joined us and noted with discernible relief that the butterball of Bob Kennedy's magazine was now a lean, mean contest machine. Everybody say I gonna come like this, said Sergio. He puffed out his cheeks so they took on the appearance of a blowfish. Tomorrow they gonna see. I gonna stop them all. He said he weighed about 240 pounds, a slight exaggeration, it seemed to me. The old Sergio, which is to say, the young, unstoppable Sergio, had weighed 225 pounds, yet was bigger and taller than this bespectacled, bald 84 version. On the other hand, it was true that what appeared to be gigantic to the eye of the childhood tended to shrink before adult inspection. We were recalling good times past, glorious times, when Joe Weider intervened. He shook Sergio's hand and whispered in his ear, Sergio, you know I've always loved you. Like you. Ask Ricky. On the 5th floor of the Doral Inn, Roy Callender was in bed watching TV. His wife Maggie took me up to their room. Roy let us in. He had on a white woolen sweats and socks under a tan trench coat. He appeared much larger than he'd been at the 81 Olympia, after which he'd given up his Montreal abode and returned to his native Barbados. But facially, Roy looked like death warmed over. When he smiled, you could almost hear his parched lips creaking under the strain, like some heavy cobweb door slowly opening on rusty hinges. I made small talk, inquired about life in Barbados, local politics, his brand new gym. He said the resort island was fine for those who learned to enjoy clean air, sun, and sunshine without money. He had a good job at the Ministry of Sport, but it meant having to work with politicians who were, well, like politicians the world over. The best part of having his own gym was the privacy it offered. In recent months, he'd given up training in the evening. His customers made it difficult for him to concentrate on his contest preparations. He'd taken a training early in the morning, from 4 to 7 daily, packing onto 3 hours more work than he'd previously done in 6, and he'd come close to killing himself. Several times he thought he might crack. But Roy had persevered. He learned to live with bone-crushing, nerve-wracking torture, and in the process discovered something. Something deep inside himself that Roy never knew was there. Roy didn't quite know how to describe it, not without sounding like a fool. But hell, Roy was pretty certain that what he discovered in himself was God. Yes, God. He'd regretted that he'd not had much exposure in the magazines of late. His fault. He should have kept in touch. And now worried that he might pay the price the next day. Bodybuilding fans were so fickle, they forget so quickly. He had missed Ben Weider's meeting on the second floor of the Doral Inn, but not deliberately. No one had seen fit to notify Roy, which in retrospect seems odd, for it was at Ben's meeting that I encountered Maggie. She said she'd spied Mohammed Makawe downstairs, and he certainly didn't look ready for a contest. Admittedly, at the time, Makawe was fully dressed. Roy expressed concern about Sergio. Would the judges treat him as just another contender, or would they succumb to the legend of the myth? Something like that had occurred at the Sydney Opera House when Arnold made his last Mr. Olympia bid. The goddamn judges looked at the nervous man who stood before them, but they saw only the glorious ghost of Arnold Pabst. So it was, said Roy, that a below-par 1980 Arnold walked away with his seventh Mr. Olympia title. No wonder Roy was depressed. Back in Los Angeles, Lou Ferrigno had promised me that if Sergio Oliva showed up in New York looking half as miraculous as he'd been in Essen 11 years before, there'd be no stopping him. Now, 2 months later, in the packed lobby of the Doral Inn, amid stampeding autograph hunters, popping flashbulbs, and regular New York insanities, I finally cornered him. Hey, Lou, I said, what you think now? He smiled like a little boy with a naughty secret. I saw him, he said. And I said, so? And he said, did you see his cheekbones? He's got to be cut under that jacket. And I said, did you see Haney? And he said, I still say Sergio can pull it off. He raised his eyes. Oh, God, I hope so. Lou first met Oliva in 1969 at the Academy of Music, minutes after he won his last Mr. Olympia. Lou was just 17, but already a lifetime member of the Oliva cult. 15 years later, he couldn't bring himself to entertain the possibility of Sergio's defeat, not against the likes of such mortals as Samir Banood and Mohammed Makawe. Even to the Incredible Hulk, some things remain sacred. Forever. Wayne D'Amelio had traveled a long way since erstwhile East Coast IFBB representative Tom Minichiello handed him his first big break, the opportunity to stage the 1975 Mr. Eastern America in New York. The show was an unqualified hit. It earned its promoter more money than Arnold had received for winning the year's Mr. Olympia. Moreover, it convinced D'Amelio that a man did not necessarily have to sweat for his bread and butter. He could promote while others did the sweating. Shortly after his highly publicized successful debut, D'Amelio was summoned to the IFBB headquarters in Montreal. Several IFBB show organizers had written to their president expressing gratitude for services rendered by D'Amelio. It seems that long before his New York contest, D'Amelio and his wife Karen had been in the habit of traveling to muscle expos all over the East Coast to lend a hand backstage or wherever else help was needed. They had carved for themselves an enviable reputation among the leading IFBB promoters and contestants and acquired on-the-job training that in due course would prove invaluable. Ben Weider had always been quick to recognize initiative. He welcomed D'Amelio, placed him on the IFBB's professional bodybuilding committee. When Tom Minichiello fell out of favor with the IFBB, D'Amelio merely slipped in to replace him. In 1978, the new favorite staged his first Night of the Champions event in New York's Town Hall. It sold out, having attracted some of the hottest pro bodybuilding names, including Robbie Robinson, who won the main prize of $10,000. Within days of the contest, D'Amelio was receiving from all over the country request tickets for his next night. His fame spread. He staged contests in Pittsburgh, Miami, California, and New Orleans, some highly successful, some not, but New York never let him down. Here he put on his Night of the Champions for 5 consecutive years. Always at a nice profit. He found himself in great demand. On behalf of the IFBB, he traveled to Australia, Egypt, the Philippines, Germany, Brussels, and London. Toward the end of 1982, D'Amelio took a call from his buddy Julie Levine. To the best of D'Amelio's recollection, Julie said he had a friend, someone he'd known a long time, who trained at a gym in Brooklyn, whose name was Eddie, who was a millionaire. By D'Amelio's account, Levine said Eddie was prepared to put up the money to stage the 84 Olympia in New York, on condition D'Amelio didn't mind taking Eddie and Julie on as partners. Eddie wanted 50% of the profits. Julie and D'Amelio would share equally whatever was left. For years, D'Amelio had dreamed of staging the Olympia in his hometown, but he wanted to do it the right way. He wanted to offer a larger purse than had ever been paid before. much more than D'Amelio could get his hands on, until Julie's call, that is. A meeting was arranged. Eddie would lay out all the money. He had connections who would jump at the opportunity to participate in the Mr. Olympia venture. D'Amelio wouldn't have to invest 1 cent. The whole thing sounded too good to be true. In January 1983, the president of the IFBB received a proposal from Eddie. If his bid for the 84 Olympia was acceptable, he would guarantee the largest purse ever offered, $100,000. The IFBB would receive $25,000 in sanction fees, $5,000 upon formal acceptance of the bid, the remaining $20,000 within 30 days of the contest. The promoters would, as required by IFBB rules, pay air transportation for all invited contenders, 7 judges, and 1 alternate. Contenders would be given free hotel accommodation and an allowance of $35 for meals. Mr. and Mrs. Ben Weider would be provided first-class air transportation, first-class hotel accommodation, and meals during the contest weekend to New York. Not long after his letter to Ben Weider, Eddie deposited in a New York account in the name of the IFBB $100,000. Then he turned to Wayne D'Amelio with a special request. As D'Amelio remembers, he asked me to do whatever was possible to get Sergio Oliva to compete in the 84 Mr. Olympia. He said Sergio had always been his idol. Unfortunately, D'Amelio had never met Sergio. No matter, having received word that their query was making a guest appearance at a contest in Albany, New York, D'Amelio and Levine set out to accomplish a mission impossible. 11 years had passed since Sergio's last IFBB adventure. By everything he told reporters, it was clear that he was still at war with the federation that had banished him for life. During the intermission, D'Amelio was introduced to Sergio. The promoter's account. The minute he heard about my connection with the IFBB, Oliva turned sour. No, no, he said, spreading his hands over his face. I don't want to talk about the IFBB or Weider or nothing. They screw me in New York. They screw me in Germany. They screw me all over. The same tired old story that everyone's heard a million times. So Levine played his card. Sergio, he said, don't you remember me? Back in the 60s, before Sergio took up bodybuilding full time, they had competed for AAU weightlifting trophies. They'd been friends. Sergio stared for a moment and suddenly his face lit up. Oh my God, I no recognize you, baby. My man, Julie. They embraced. And while D'Amelio looked on, Levine explained their predicament. He and his friend, Wayne, had contracted to stage the 84 Mr. Olympia at the Felt Forum. The big problem was that their millionaire backer, who worshipped Oliva, was insisting on his return. Chances were that if Sergio refused to compete, the millionaire fan would pull out of the deal. Still, Sergio didn't want to know. But Levine persisted. He said the IFBB was now a different organization from what Sergio remembered. The old horses had either died or disappeared. Joe Weider took no part in contest decisions. Judges were selected by the IFBB's special committee. Sergio promised to give the matter serious consideration. In the months that followed, the three men communicated by telephone. It was no easy job getting Sergio to let go of the past. For more than a decade, he'd held fast to the belief that Joe Weider had been behind his fall from prominence. Excising the notion from his mind had to be equal to a do-it-yourself lobotomy. No one knows for certain what finally turned Sergio around. Maybe it had something to do with the Mr. Olympia prize money. $50,000 was more than a patrolman Oliva could earn in 2 years. A baby was on the way. The money was certainly coming handy. Almost 1 year after D'Amelio and Levine first talked about their joint promotion and their mission impossible, they reported back to their millionaire backer. The tiger was in the bag. Sergio had agreed to compete in his first IFBB event in over a decade. He even agreed to be interviewed for Weider's newest magazine, Flex. What a coup. Shortly after the Oliva story appeared in print, the promoters of the 84 Mr. Olympia made another important public announcement. The 5,000-seat Felt Forum had sold out. Everyone had good reason to celebrate. The Garden was hardly foreign territory. It had been venue for the IFBB's 10th Mr. Olympia when a still-hungry Arnold had taken the opportunity to not only put an overambitious Lou Ferrigno in his place, but also to serve notice on all dreamers that for as long as he damn well pleased, the Big O would remain his personal property. Frank Zane had good reason to remember. In 1974, when the Mr. Olympia was wrapped up in class distinction, he had come ever so close to winning the under 200-pound division. That decision had gone to Arnold's cocky sidekick, Franco Colombo. And after all these years, that had been, to Frank, an unsolvable puzzlement. Of course, one dumb decision did not a loser make. Frank had gone on to win the Big O on three consecutive occasions, a record that in the 19-year history of the contest had been attained by only two other men. One was in Italy filming his next moneymaker, and the other, after an 11-year absence, would on this day, November 3rd, 1984, try for his fourth Mr. Olympia victory. Precipient devil that he is, Frank had chosen this year to stay out of the fray. For a nice fat fee, Frank had allowed NBC to talk him into making like Frank Gifford. While the 84 Mr. Olympia contender sweated with hope, Frank would enthrall TV viewers with his educated eye view of the IFBB's most important event. Bruno, the garden's chief security officer, also remembered the 74 Olympia. He'd been on duty that night. Now at 8 a.m. with the New York atmosphere determined to keep sunny California on my mind, all Bruno wanted to talk about was how Arnold and Lou had both done bodybuilding proud and were destined to become major movie stars and multimillionaires. From Bruno's point of view, the two former Mr. Olympia campaigners were further proof that bodybuilders weren't dumb at any rate, no more so than politicians, for instance. Bruno regretted that Red Sonja was keeping Arnold in Italy, that he wouldn't be attending the 84 Mr. Olympia. Bruno had set his heart on seeing Arnold again. Still, there was consolation in the fact that Lou Ferrigno, Frank Zane, and Franco Colombo would be present. Among other early birds at the forum were promoters Wayne D'Amelia and Julie Levine, their wives Karen and Sandy, Frank and Christine Zane, and an NBC camera crew. Wayne D'Amelia supervised the lighting arrangement and the hoisting of the new Mr. Olympia banner. It cost the promoters $1,200. Elsewhere in the theater, the Levines did their best to cope with the last-minute demands for non-existent tickets. Over the gabble of cleaning ladies and electricians, I overheard this conversation between an NBC producer and Wayne D'Amelia. Wayne, will you please tell me before the announcements who are the winners? Why? Because I'd like to focus on the faces of the losers. D'Amelia promised to do his best. Another time, the producer wanted D'Amelia to indicate wives and girlfriends of the various contenders. Why, asked the promoter, because I want to show the strain or elation on their faces as their men perform on stage. D'Amelia said he didn't think that was such a great idea. Why, asked the producer, because you never know who has a wife at home while his girlfriend's at the show. The Mr. Olympia preliminaries were scheduled for 2 p.m. The evening performance would begin at 8 p.m. At 1 p.m., Julie Levine left the forum in a huge bus to pick up the contenders at the Doral Inn. I went along for the ride, perchance to catch some interesting conversation, strictly in the line of duty, of course. Boyer Coe talked about his short-lived career with Nautilus, the exercise equipment manufacturers. Others spoke longingly of favorite dishes resisted, in the interest of Mr. Olympia ambitions. Will contenders please line up? We're on in 5 minutes. The first of several such calls came at 1:45. The appeals fell on unhearing ears. Outside one dressing room door, Mrs. Robbie Robinson stood guard while her husband meditated, fully dressed, inside, his flat top Carl Lewis haircut, the most striking aspect of his appearance. 2 weeks earlier, Franco Colombo had predicted that Robbie would be the surprise of the 84 Olympia. I could barely wait for the unveiling. Mohamed Makawe, by now a Mr. Olympia veteran, occupied two chairs, one for regular service, the other for his feet. If a cool demeanor meant a man had no worries, then Makawe had to be in seventh heaven. On the other hand, the face of James Gobert suggested first-degree depression. Sergio Oliva was his old self, carrying on about the short time available for pumping up when he needed at least an hour, evoking memories of bizarre dressing room scenes from his glorious heyday, altogether anachronistic in his new setting. He grabbed a barbell and, still attired in his blue sweatsuit, did a series of bent-over rows. Nearby, a Michael Jackson Tony Pearson was anointing himself in Johnson's baby oil. Observing me, observing him, Tony said, "Hey, Rick, thanks for all the magazine publicity." His eyes begging for approval, he pointed to his tensed right thigh at the precise moment that Sergio chose to look up and said, "I'm ready. I'm going to eat him up like candy." "Great," I said automatically. You do not contradict a man's nurtured opinion of himself, not minutes before the toughest challenge to his manhood. Sergio grunted, brushed past Tony, and ordered me to follow him into a nearby toilet, where he unceremoniously dropped his sweatpants and growled, "He talk about candy. I show him candy." "Wow," I exclaimed, my enthusiasm mechanism still on automatic. Actually, I was thinking that even though they were still amazing, Sergio's thighs were no longer the carved ebony pillars that 16 years earlier had brought tears to Arnold's eyes. Last call. Anyone not on stage in 2 seconds will be disqualified. The line had never failed to get any attention. I dashed toward the dressing room exit past a wild-eyed Samir Banute, who took the opportunity to shriek, "Pencil neck," in my ear, friends we hadn't been of late. Desperate to get to my seat, I made it just in time to hear the announcer say, "Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the greatest bodybuilding event in 19 years. Our first Mr. Olympia contestant is Sergio Oliva." Of course, New York, the city that made Oliva, where the whole Mr. Olympia idea first took root and blossomed, was eager to pay homage to its creations. Naturally, the packed house exploded at the sound of his name. Sergio received his first standing ovation even before he actually appeared on stage. Poor Samir Ruck walked right into the noise. Bill Grant and Bob Birdsong, too. Tom Platz was next, and New York accorded him the same warm reception that Tom had received in London in 82 and in Germany the following year, never mind that he was only there as a guest poser at the Mr. Olympia. Nice guys do not always finish last. Albert Beckles took the noise some decibels higher and was followed by Robbie Robinson, Bob Paris, Chris Dickerson, Tony Pearson, Chuck Williams, Appy Steenbeck, and Hubert Metz, all of whom received warm applause. With the appearance of Josip Wilkosz, the atmosphere heated up again. Roy Callender stoked the fire, as did Boyer Coe, Lee Haney, and Muhammad Mokawi. Charles Glass and James Gobert followed them to complete the semicircle around the posing platform. So now you want to know, was the 84 Mr. Olympia lineup truly the greatest ever? On paper, perhaps. After all, it boosted three former Mr. Olympia winners, Oliva, Dickerson, and Banute, none of whom was in the shape that had won them special distinction. Where I am concerned, Sergio's special contribution to the event had little to do with his physique. The audience and I would have been happy to see him again if he'd chosen only to make a guest appearance. He didn't have to put his invincibility on the line. If he needed money, he could have chosen to make his peace with the IFBB and then let it be known that he was available for exhibitions. IFBB promoters everywhere would have welcomed him. The fans would have eaten him up. He'd have earned a small fortune over the next 2 years, especially if he'd taken the time to whip himself into regular Oliva shape. In New York, he was not quite as tempered as he'd been at his last Mr. Olympia adventure. 6 more weeks of serious preparation could have rendered him unbeatable at the Forum, where Sergio displayed what was still very much a young man's physique. The lines were in his face only, more a consequence of Spartan diets than age, as Frank Zane, Franco Colombo, and Arnold Schwarzenegger can attest to. What we saw at the Forum was a not quite contest-ready Oliva. He may have underestimated the competition. After all, who could have anticipated the transformed Lee Haney? Never before had a physique contestant so easily outclassed his opposition. Not only were Lee's best body parts, back, chest, waist, thighs, better than ever, previously weak areas were now in harmony with the rest of his incredible body. From the moment Haney stepped on stage, it was clear that Chris Dickerson's ambition, Samir's too, of course, of winning the Big O more than once was nothing more than a pipe dream, in 1984 at any rate. Tom Platz was also marked for disappointment. Bob Paris was impressive. Those who say he lacked mass, he weighed close to 240 at around 6 feet, might be interested in something Steve Reeves once told me. People are forever asking what I might have developed into had I continued to train for contests past the age of 23. I certainly would have allowed myself to grow bigger. I believe that a structure can take on only so much mass before it loses its symmetry and becomes grotesque. I'd have developed more cuts, but that's all. Perhaps Paris, who has often been likened to Reeves, has similar ideas. One thing for certain, in all of bodybuilding, there isn't a more beautifully structured physique. It remains to be seen whether or not this post-Michelangelo David changes into Goliath for future Mr. Olympia raids. Chuck Williams and Charles Glass had been phenomenal when they won their divisions at the 1983 American Bodybuilding Championships. In New York, they showed none of the cuts that had made them such hits in San Jose, nor the muscle mass for that matter. Tony Pearson is always beautiful, but Mr. Olympia material he is not. Not at this juncture. And the least said about James Gobert, the hit of the 1982 American Championships, the better. As noted earlier, Franco Colombo had warned me to expect a Robbie Robinson Mr. Olympia victory. I suspected at the time that Franco had chosen to bet, no money was involved, of course, on Robbie because the 76 through 81 Olympia winner couldn't bring himself to bet on Tom Platz and others who made life rough for him at his last Mr. Olympia bid. Of course, Franco insisted that wasn't the case, that in fact he'd seen Robbie in training and he couldn't believe the shape he was in. In New York, Robbie was pathetic. Albert Beckles was, of course, tremendous, as was Bob Birdsong. But Bill Grant missed the boat along with the Germans, Appy Steenbeck and Hubert Metz. Fellow countryman Joseph Wilcox, on the other hand, was stupendous. Boyer Coe? Suffice it to say that he had improved on his best parts, which underscored inferior characteristics. Roy Callender was still depressed. Indeed, his skin appeared to have changed overnight from coal black to ash gray. Which brings us to Mohamed Makawe, probably the smallest man in the event. Of course, that had long ceased to work against the Egyptian. He had a special knack for bringing giants to their knees. In his time, he wiped out the likes of Lee Haney, Boyer Coe, Casey Viator, and Albert Beckles. It seemed to me that in New York, Makawe was not nearly as sharp as he'd been in London and Germany. But then what did that matter when 75% of the 84 Mr. Olympia lineup was not at their best? Does all this suggest a thrill-free contest? If so, forgive me. The Mr. Olympia preliminaries were not without an exciting moment or two. There was a time when a sweating Sergio suddenly descended from the posing platform, walked toward the judging panel, and then wham, 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 cranked out three most muscular poses that seemed to fill the theater to the ecstatic delight of fans and other contenders. And of course, there were Lee Haney's breathtaking displays of inseparable Mr. Olympia artillery. The preliminaries ended around 5 p.m. Backstage, I eavesdropped as Frank Zane gingerly interviewed Sergio on camera. Earlier, Frank had asked me what I thought would be the most appropriate time to talk to Sergio. Bearing in mind the possible result of the contest, I had advised Frank to catch him before the evening performance. "Why did you come back?" asked the interviewer. "Because," said Sergio, sweat pouring down his forehead into his eyes, "I am in the greatest shape of my life." Zane had been one of the contenders in the 1972 Mr. Olympia when Sergio was indeed at his best. He chose not to contradict the dreamer. Instead, he asked, "How much longer can you go on?" Sergio explained what Zane already knew, that if a man took good care of himself, he could go on competing almost indefinitely, maybe until he was 60. "And I'm not even 45, said Sergio. I-43. In the evening, another full house turned out to see the most predictable Mr. Olympia since 1968, when no one had showed up to challenge Oliva. Midway through Ben Weider's welcome speech, the crowd suddenly erupted, drowning out the IFBB president. Lou Ferrigno and his father, Matt, had just made their grand entrance. Ben waited for the commotion to subside. It didn't. How could it, with Lou throwing double bicep shots all over the place? Finally, the presidential voice sounded, "Please, Lou, sit down so we can get on." When Ben resumed, he said, "Actually, this Mr. Olympia is going to be a battle of the giants. The majority are in top shape. There can only be one winner. We went out of our way to pick seven of the world's best judges. They come from Belgium, Canada, USA, Czechoslovakia, Singapore, Germany, and Holland. We spent a lot of money to bring you the finest judges in the IFBB." The audience applauded when Ben reminded them that the Mr. Olympia purse had grown from a measly $1,000 to $100,000. Moreover, that in 1985, there'd be even more money for the Mr. Olympia winners. "We have one small disappointment," Ben said. "Bertel Fox didn't make it." When the crowd booed, Ben explained that the IFBB had received a letter from Bertel and a certificate from his physician explaining Bertel's absence. "The poor fellow has a bad back," said Ben. "Chicken," roared a group of doubting Thomases. In due course, Ben Weider received a special award for his contributions to bodybuilding, as did his brother Joe. Wayne D'Amelio also received the plaque for his efforts. And then it was on with the show. Actually, it amounted to this. Each contestant went through his posing routine to the recorded music of his choice. As before, Sergio was first on stage. Nothing fancy here, just a series of house-breaking most muscular shots, the famous arms overhead pose, still mind-boggling after all these years, and the Oliva double bicep. Ah, but enough to earn Sergio his third or fourth standing ovation. Oh, yes. Again, Samir ran into the tail end of Sergio's exhaust. But in all fairness, I should add that Samir was better during the evening performance than he'd been earlier. That is, during the afternoon preliminaries, he was even less muscular. Albert Beckles and Bob Birdsong posed to disco beats. That Albert got away with it was due only to the amazing amount of muscle he carried on around the stage. Birdsong was another story. His was the silliest display I've ever witnessed at a physique show. Lee Haney had obviously not come out to fool around. He posed like a professional, and he brought the house down. As always, Makawe was in a class all of his own. When this Egyptian gets going, Macho Man drops his guard and is in danger of becoming an appreciator of La Belle. You actually found yourself wondering if what Haney had done would be enough to keep Makawe at bay. Such a fine poser he is. Bill Grant didn't make the finals. Neither did Boyer Coe, Chris Dickerson, Robbie Robinson, Chuck Williams, Appy Steenbeck, Hubert Metz, Charles Glass, or James Gobert. So having cleared the stage, Wayne D'Amelio brought out the heavies. Sergio Oliva, Samir Benoit, Bob Birdsong, Tom Platz, Albert Beckles, Bob Parris, Yosef Wilkosh, Roy Callender, Lee Haney, and Muhammad Makawe. Now it was time for the excuse for chaos that passes for a pose down. Haney, shouted 90% of the rioters. Sergio, others hollered. A barefaced few rooted for Samir. Show him what you've got, screamed an altogether loyal Lisa, Albert's true love. Go, Lee, squealed Shirley Haney. Go, Haney. 2 years earlier, her husband had given her the American Bodybuilding Championships as a first wedding present. Now he planned to give her the whole ball of wax as a birthday gift. Not even the love that Lisa held for Albert could compare with Lee's devotion to Shirley. At last, the final result. In 10th place, Bob Birdsong. Birdsong accepted his check for $1,000 with a face that wasn't worth a nickel. In 9th place, Tom Platz. He took his money with all the grace he could muster. In 8th place, it seemed that D'Amelio had suddenly lost his voice. His eyes opened wide. His lips moved, but no sound left his throat. Then, with a determined look, he blurted out, Sergio Oliva. Boo! The house was in an uproar. But Sergio, famous for his short temper, kept his cool. Or so it seemed, initially. Sergio's face tightened suddenly, and now I knew a time bomb was ticking away in his head that at any moment would explode. I saw him take a deep breath and brace myself for the worst. Then I found myself running towards the stage, shouting desperately, cool it, Sergio. Let it go. Keep your head. From the corner of my eye, I spied Arlene Oliva coming down the aisle, headed toward the backstage area, the four-week-old Oliva baby in her arms. Give him to me, Arlene, please, I pleaded. Let Sergio show him off to the audience. And she did. Arlene let me take her baby, and I passed him on to his father. Sergio, I screamed. Here, take him. Go to the lectern. Make a good speech. A thank you speech. Through all of that, the crowd continued to boo. Sergio looked down at me, a dazed look in his eyes. Then to my relief, he bent down and picked up baby Sergio, held him aloft, and then headed toward the mic. A good speech, Sergio, I called out again. Oh, he was magnificent. He thanked the now silent audience, thanked all who had rooted for him, who had remained faithful for nearly 20 years. A wonderful speech. Afterward, Wayne D'Amelio continued with his announcements. Bob Parris, Samir Benoit, Roy Callender, and Albert Beckles took 7th, 6th, 5th, and 4th, respectively. In 3rd place, D'Amelio went on, Yosef Wilkosh, he gets $10,000. The audience held its breath for the next all-important announcement. After all, at Muscle Contest, anything can happen. In 2nd place, the announcer paused for effect, Mohamed Makawe. It was pointless making the final announcement, but D'Amelio did it anyway. Mr. Olympia, 1984, Lee Haney. There had never been a more popular decision. Lee picked up his check for $50,000, and then he posed for the ritual pictures. Posed, then signaled to Shirley, who came bounding from the wings. Together, they approached the mic. Lee thanked the audience for their support, and then he said, it's been a great night for Shirley and me. I have achieved my dream, but I also want to say meeting Sergio Oliva will remain one of the highlights of my life. Indeed, throughout the contest, Lee had treated Oliva with reverence. Sergio was hardly a threat on this occasion, and Lee saw no reason to parade over him. He did what he had to do and no more, unlike some who ended up losers anyway. My most memorable moment came when Sergio, baby in hand, said, no matter what happened tonight, 8th, 17th, or 20th, I forever be the myth. And I hold in my arm Sergio Jr., the next myth. It was the first time Sergio had ever used the soubriquet in my presence. I had given it to him at our first meeting in 1967. On the night of November 3rd, 1984, it seemed to me that no one better deserved the nickname. And so ended the IFBB's 19th Mr. Olympia. All that remained was the postmortem. All right. Long article, but that was great. We got to see some of the stuff that Rick talked about in our interview, including giving the baby to Sergio and all of the backstage information that only Rick Wayne can bring. So that was an awesome article. And like Rick said, we just don't see that anymore because the magazines aren't around, unfortunately. So we just don't get to see that great writing that Rick Wayne and Jack Neary and Peter McGuff and many others brought to the magazines every month. So we only have them in memory now, guys. So that's why I'm reading them to you every week here on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right. Thanks for listening to another show. We will be back next week with another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Until then, stay safe, train hard, and we'll see you next week. Take care.